You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. More and more people are riding bikes on unpaved roads. Coming up, we'll talk about the appeal of gravel biking and some fun places in the state to do it. Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. We're checking in with reporters around the state about what they've been covering. First, the La Crosse County District Attorney is proposing an idea to help the police department avoid publicly criticizing local judges and instead handle frustrations over particular cases through official channels. Besma Ammer is the public safety reporter for the La Crosse Tribune. Besma, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what got people in La Crosse, Besma, thinking about this issue of open criticism and bad dialogue between police and the judges in the area?
So I came to La Crosse in, late 2018, and it was actually the first big story I wrote here. It seems that there is a lot of criticism when it comes to La Crosse judges letting people out on bond, low bond, signature bond, and a lot of people view them as repeat offenders who are being let go. Now, the criticism is essentially coming from the police department, which is very vocal about, their feelings of basically catching these criminals or alleged criminals and then having them back on the streets. So I think that that's kind of what the issue is, in essence. It happened a couple of weeks ago where, again, Assistant Chief Rob Abraham criticized one of the judges for letting out an alleged criminal. And I think that the way the DA chose to resolve the issue was to say, okay, there are going to be interdepartmental issues and frustrations. How do we deal with them? Because maybe we can point things out to each other instead of, going on social media, going, to news outlets. How about we talk? And I understand that a lot of people may not understand public meetings, but it's a public meeting. These are not closed doors where the public isn't allowed. If you want to know what's happening, you can go to those meetings. I mean, the meeting is every third Wednesday of the month at 7:30 a.m. You can go see what happens.
Now, there's some bad blood, you say, publicly, it sounds like, over these public statements from the police department, their feelings about the judges. How are all the parties responding to this idea of, okay, let's have these meetings to hash this stuff out?
So they responded positively. I mean, you have everybody who has something to do with the criminal justice department in this meeting. And they were all very positive. They felt like, okay, this is a great step, a step in the right direction. I think that from my understanding, this is, again, my own perspective, that the interim chief or acting chief, Rob Abraham, has issues with, bond, but that had he not vocalized his opinion in, using social media, that nobody would have given this issue attention. I don't know if that's true. I can't say for sure, but I think that the police department has enough say to go to these departments directly and talk to them. But I don't know if that's happened and nothing's come of it as well. So I can't really say what's happened in the past, only what's happening now.
Now, this critical incident review process, it's new. Of course, we can't predict the outcome. Does it seem, at least at the outset, to be dialing down the tensions between various parts of the law and law enforcement there?
I honestly don't know. It seems people at the meeting were very responsive, and they liked the idea. And I think that, again, it's, hopefully a step in the right direction. But I can't predict the future.
Sure.
We're just going to have to wait and see what happens.
All right. Besma, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Besma Ammer is the public safety reporter for the La Crosse Tribune. She was with us to talk about a new proposal in La Crosse to discourage public criticism between police and local judges. Now, more than 11,000 customers in downtown Madison lost power today after fires at two of Madison Gas and Electric's power substations. That led Governor Evers to declare a state of emergency for the city and Dane County. Bridget Bowden is WPR Special Projects Reporter. She's been helping cover this today. Bridget, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
What is the latest when it comes to the power outages right now?
Right. So I actually just checked the MG&E power outage maps, and it looks like at this point most of the power outages have been resolved. I think the number of outages is down to the single digits now, where earlier today it was up near 11,000. So mostly resolved.
A lot of people may have seen dramatic images online on TV. I think CNN is picking this up because it's, big flames, a lot of smoke. Amazingly, as of the last press conference you attended, no injuries?
As of the midday press briefing, there were no injuries. And you're right, that plume was very dramatic. I actually saw it out my bedroom window this morning.
Yeah, off
huge.
My back porch, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Do we know anything about the cause of the fires and explosions?
So earlier today, MG&E officials tweeted that they believe the fire was caused by a mechanical issue. And it said that they believe it wasn't related to the summer heat. But as of right now, everything is still being investigated.
And there were two actually separate substations that caught fire.
Right. So there was a fire and an explosion at the substation near East Wash, East Washington Avenue, on the east side of the Capitol. And then there was another fire at a substation on East Campus Mall, which is on campus.
And this comes on probably the hottest day or one of the hottest days of the year. How did the city respond to people and facilities losing air conditioning?
Right. So the Kohl Center on campus was immediately opened as a cooling center, and I believe it's still open as a cooling center until 6 p.m. this evening. Also, the libraries were open as cooling centers, and Madison Water Utility actually had a water truck up on State Street giving out water to people who needed to drink.
All right, Bridget, we'll keep watching for details. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bridget Bowden is WPR Special Projects Reporter. She talked with us about the power outages in downtown Madison and fires at electrical substations. You can follow updates at WPR.org. Finally, a major operator of frac sand mines in Wisconsin, Emerge Energy Services, declared bankruptcy on Monday. That leaves the future of their mines up in the air. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, how you doing, Rob?
Good. You've been following frac sand for a long time. Give us a sense of the size and reach of Emerge Energy Services operations in the state.
So Emerge Energy has been described as a top-tier company, and what that means is it's one of the large players, or it has been. It has 8 frac sand mining operations. That includes mines and processing facilities. Those are located in Barron and Chippewa counties. The company just went through explosive growth between 2011 and 2014, and then the market started to change. Oil prices dropped, and demand for frac sand went down. They've kind of come back a bit, but in the meantime, a lot of companies have started using sand from places like Texas because it's close to the oil wells in Texas, so you don't need to pay the huge shipping costs to move it from Wisconsin.
Bankruptcy doesn't mean they close up shop immediately, I guess. What do we know about the future of their existing mines?
Well, it's hard to navigate these bankruptcy filings, but the company says that there are still 2 processing facilities and 1 mine operating in Wisconsin. But it kind of means that other than that, the company is basically... It ran out of money. It owes $338 million to debtors all over the place, including some in Wisconsin. One of those companies is Market & Johnson, a construction company based in Eau Claire, which is owed $6 million. But the documents provided by Emerge Energy seem to say that the goal is to restructure the company and continue operation throughout the process. So really, it's unknown what's going to happen with these properties and with this company, what it'll look like when it comes out the other end.
As you've reported, another unknown is the future of mining sites and remediation there. How do frac sand companies and local governments plan for the future of these sites?
State statute requires companies to basically fill the mine when they're done with mining activities. That means they call it reclamation. So they have to get a permit from the local unit of government, the county, town, etc. And that ensures that they have to recontour the land and reseed it and try to bring it to like prairie or forest or farmland. So these counties, Chippewa and Barron and other counties in Wisconsin, require cash bonds to be kept in case a company goes out of business. And Chippewa County has $3 million in bonds set aside for reclamation. They tried this April to get another $1.7 million from the company, but now they're not sure whether, you know, it's unclear what'll happen now that the company's actually going through bankruptcy proceedings itself. The county official told me that they're hoping that the courts will settle that.
Emerge Energy was, I guess still is, a big frac sand player in the state. Are there, as they file for bankruptcy, are there other companies, other operations still in business?
There are, but they've dialed way back. Security and Exchange Commission filings from some of the publicly traded companies like your High Crush, Covia, they have all said that the demand for Northern White, which is what they call sand from Wisconsin, is way down. And because of that, they're shifting their operations. Some of these companies are paying large amounts of monies to build sand mines in places like Texas, Oklahoma, places closer to the oil wells. So a lot of other mines have shut down operations. They call it idling. So they're not officially closing the mine. Therefore, they don't have to do the reclamation, but they're just not actively mining.
Rich, you've been following this for a while. It's this amazing boom and bust story you've been telling us. Is there any thought in our last few moments that these could make a comeback if circumstances change?
Well, if there's anything that I've learned over the 8 years that I've covered this industry, is it changes so fast. So there's no telling. I mean, there's some thought that if oil operations ramp up in the Bakken, which is in North Dakota, sand from Wisconsin could be more in demand. So it's shifted so much and it's changed so much, the technology. It's hard to say what it'll look like 5 years from now.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Reb.
Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. He was with us to talk about what's next for frac sand mines owned by Emerge Energy Services after the company declared bankruptcy on Monday. You've heard of road bikes, mountain bikes, commuter bikes, bicycles built for two, but what about gravel bikes? They're kind of an in-between between a road bike and a mountain bike, and they're designed for riding over unpaved roads. And they're becoming really popular. According to bicycle retailer, gravel bike sales in the U.S. hit $10 million in early 2017. A year later, they nearly tripled to $29 million. In addition, Outside Magazine says in 2017, the number of bikes shipped in the U.S. overall, including traditional mountain and road models, fell by 4% from the previous year, but gravel bike shipments continue to climb. So what's so great about gravel biking, and where can we do it in Wisconsin? Kirsten Klockner is a personal trainer and cycling coach in Middleton. She's also a monthly columnist for Silent Sports Magazine and a contributor to Roots Rated. Kirsten, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, help us understand the appeal here. What makes riding on gravel paths and roads so much fun?
Well, I started doing it to get away from traffic primarily and to be able to get into areas that most people don't get to see. The gravel roads bring you by amazing wildlife and nature areas.
What's different about a gravel bike as compared to, say, a street bike?
The main difference is the tire size and the clearance. So I like to ride now a 42-millimeter tire, whereas a lot of road bikes are 25-millimeter tires. And then they're also a little bit longer, so more stable when you are on loose gravel.
But you can still ride them on a road like a normal road bike, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I've been riding my bike that I use for gravel events. I will do a 100-mile century on it on road.
Now, it sounds to me like it's going to be, if you're riding on a gravel road, I'm pretty familiar with gravel roads, they're kind of bumpy. Is it a rocky ride?
It all depends. Most of the gravel in southern Wisconsin, northern Illinois, or all of Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota are crushed limestone, and they break down. Some of them are actually just as smooth as a paved road. When you head up north, north of Highway 8, it tends to be crushed granite and chunkier gravel, bigger aggregate, and definitely bumpier. But that's where the bigger tires help with the lower tire pressure.
Now, one of our producers has a gravel bike now. He's the one. And he saw this story, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal. This is a nationwide trend. Do you see this as something that more and more people are getting into?
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of my road racing friends have gone over to doing gravel rides and gravel events because they are so much fun, a little bit more laid back, and you don't have to worry as much about cars.
Talking to Kirsten Klockner from Middleton, talking about gravel biking. It's catching on, it sounds like. Now, I'm from Michigan, Kirsten. We had a lot of dirt roads, a surprising amount of dirt roads. I grew up on one there. They're easy to find. How about in Wisconsin? Do you have to go looking for these? Are they easy to find?
Well, here in the Dane County area and then the surrounding counties, we don't have many gravel roads because of the dairy industry. Most of the roads were paved for that purpose. So I usually have to drive about an hour and a half to 2 hours to find gravel roads. The area close to the river, Wyalusing State Park area, also some areas around Viroqua, and then far north has a lot of gravel, north of Highway 8. But it is a drive.
Now, how about going onto paths, biking paths that would normally be, I guess, dirt bikes people would go on? Can you do that on your gravel bike?
As in mountain bike trails?
Right, yeah, that kind of thing.
So if your skills are high enough, absolutely. I have ridden.
Not the place to start, though.
Correct. Just because there's toe overlap, and you usually have drop bars on gravel bikes. I have ridden many single track, easier trails on my gravel bike. It's a great way to work on your skills.
Okay. So, but again, not for the beginner.
Correct.
It sounds like. Is this something that people are just out there doing on their own, or do we have groups? Do we have events for gravel biking?
All of the above. I do a lot of riding on my own. However, I do oftentimes 5, 6, 7 events a year. The events are becoming much more numerous, and they oftentimes fill up. So all the ones that I have done this year are at capacity. And as I said, a lot of road riders are filtering into that. I love the solitude, though. Sometimes I'll go out with a couple of friends or just myself and do 100 miles of gravel riding solo.
What kind of events do you have coming up?
The biggest one right now that I'm just about getting ready to do is the Day Across Minnesota, the Dam. And we start in South Dakota, ride at midnight, ride across the whole state of Minnesota.
Wow.
To the Wisconsin border in under 24 hours. And this will be the biggest undertaking. I've had 240 to 245 miles.
Now, how do you get ready for that in terms of food, sleep, the sort of things you might fit into that 24-hour cycle usually?
You have to train for it, actually. And tonight, I'm going to be doing my last shakedown ride, which will be 150 miles of gravel trail, leaving at 2 a.m. So I did a 200-miler a couple weeks ago alone overnight. And you start working out how often you need to eat, what you crave during that time. I found that I don't like sweet things. I prefer the salty fatty. Mm-hmm. And then also finding out how much water you need for the conditions out there.
Well, that's next door in Minnesota. Do we have events here in Wisconsin yet?
Absolutely. In fact, I just signed up for the Hibernator, which is going to be up in Leona, so north of 8 or right on 8, Highway 8. And there are three options, 32-miler, 65-miler, and 107-miler, I want to say. And that is amazing country. It's all on fire roads and some ATV trails, free event. But any donations go to help support the rescue squad, the fire and rescue squad.
Hmm. Hibernator.
Yes,
is that
the
getting
Hibernator.
Close to winter? Is that the theme there? Or?
Early October.
Okay.
October 5th, I want to say.
Now, you mentioned that sometimes you get to see wildlife while you're doing this. What kind of things, what are some of your best sightings for your gravel bike?
A lot of fox, coyote, ooh, cranes, of course. I have a lot of friends who have run into bear and moose.
Not literally run into, I hope.
Very close.
Okay. Wow.
In fact, the Hibernator course, there have been many bear spottings up on that course. On my 200-miler, I ran into a mink.
Okay. You don't get to see them that often.
Right?
They're kind of elusive, I guess is the word.
Absolutely. So that was a real treat, and I was alone. I couldn't share it with anybody, but it made me very excited.
Now, if there's somebody out there listening thinking, yeah, this does sound like a lot of fun, how would they get started?
I think the best thing to do is go into a bike shop and make sure that your bike is suitable for riding gravel. And if not, getting either a cross bike, a gravel-specific bike, or a hybrid bike that can fit wider tires. Having the right tires is everything. And then learning what tire pressure you should be riding at. I made the big mistake of riding far too high of tire pressure in the beginning, and it makes it for a very unsafe and uncomfortable ride. And I usually tell people, start out with one of the limestone rail trails. It's a great way to start. And then work up to gravel roads. Maybe start with a short event like a 30-miler. And go from there.
Don't start with that 24-hour Trans-Minnesota expedition.
Some people do. I wouldn't suggest it. I don't think that it would be a whole lot of fun.
And how late into the season have you gone gravel biking? What, you know, snow and ice, I assume, would be a little too hazardous? No?
Absolutely not. In fact, there's an event down in northern Illinois that we do every year called the Freezeroo, and it is 40 miles and at the end of February.
Well, on a 95-degree day, a little freezeroo doesn't sound too bad, does it?
I don't know if I prefer either. I think 80,
split the difference.
Sunny, dry, yes.
Kirsten, it sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks a lot for sharing it with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Kirsten Klockner is a personal trainer and cycling coach in Middleton. She's also a monthly columnist for Silent Sports magazine. We talked to her about the growing popularity of gravel biking around the country and here in Wisconsin. The bill that would raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour over a six-year span passed the U.S. House yesterday. That would mean more than doubling the current minimum wage, which right now sits at a little over $7 an hour. The plan was a big priority for Democrats, passing mostly along party lines. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talking after that vote yesterday.
The Raise the Wage Act gives up to 33 million Americans a long overdue raise. 33 million Americans. And lifts so many people out of poverty. This bill honors the dignity of work, grows the economy, and upholds the bedrock idea of fairness in our country, that hard work deserves a decent wage.
That said, the bill's not likely to make it through the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said the chamber will not take up the bill. David Pate is the chair and associate professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee's School of Social Welfare. He's also an affiliate professor with the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for inviting me, Rob.
Can you talk a little more about what this plan for House Democrats would do over time?
Well, this bill, H.R. 582, what it would do would, one, phase in over 6 years. The whole idea of raising the minimum wage, the first amount would be $8.40, I think it is. And then we would gradually get to where we're at $15. It's going to do some significant things for families, in particular women and people of color, and particularly those who are rurally located in our country.
Let's talk about the history of the minimum wage a little bit. It is where it is now. It's been there for a while. Can you talk about what that minimum wage means today?
Sure. The Fair Labor Standards Act, which started in 1939 under Hugo Black, who was the senator who became a Supreme Court justice, it was done to ensure that all work could be fairly rewarded and that regular employment would provide a decent standard of living. We have not had any raise around the minimum wage for the last 10 years. The first minimum wage, just so you know, was 25 cents, and that would be about $4 now. But the minimum wage has been something that is required. You must pay people at minimum wage, but there are certain professions where you don't have to pay a minimum wage based on the tips that they receive.
And this plan would also, I believe, phase out the reduced federal minimum for tipped workers?
It definitely would, and that would be an excellent opportunity to provide a better standard of living for those who are dependent on tips. Now, the one caveat about being a tip worker is that if you receive at least $30 in tips, you don't have to pay them the minimum wage. But you're supposed to, if someone gets below $30 in tips, they're supposed to be able to get the federal minimum wage.
When the minimum wage is stagnant, the number stays the same over time. That doesn't really mean it's the same over time, right? Because of how inflation and the cost of living work.
Exactly. Because, you know, due to the fact that there's inflation and there's also the cost of living and different things that change over time. So therefore, the current amount of money that people have now in minimum wage for the last 10 years has decreased their ability to buy and spend the same way.
The Congressional Budget Office says it's a mixed bag here. 1.3 million people could be lifted out of poverty, they say. But about the same number of jobs could be lost. And that's always an argument against the idea of increases, especially substantial increases, to the minimum wage. How do you weigh that?
But also the CBO does say, too, the 17 million jobs would also be affected by raising their pay. It also says that still the benefits outweigh the losses because people will have more money. There'll be more money spent in the economy. And also another study, if we look at just the CBO study, that's one way. But the EPI estimates that 28 million workers will be affected with another 11.6 million million workers being affected, because if someone raised salaries going to the 15, others would be up raised as well to retain those workers.
Talking about the minimum wage with David Pate from the UW-Milwaukee and UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts on the idea of increasing the minimum wage. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, you mentioned earlier the impact this could have on people of color. Are people of color often in these minimum wage jobs?
Definitely. You know, based on education level, access, who you know, who gives you a job, there's a large disproportionate number of blacks and brown people who are in service to industry jobs. However, the majority of people who will be affected by this bill will be white people, then blacks, then Latinx, and then those who are Asian. Disproportionately, though, it will be the reverse. So it will be blacks, Latinx, whites, and then Asians. But again, if you do a race and gender analysis, it's women who are black. With children, being a single parent.
We've seen some cities and states tackle the minimum wage on their own. And some people have made the case that that's better because, okay, if you have a high cost of living city, you need that higher minimum wage. There are areas of the country with more depressed economies. It's going to be harder for employers to pay those wages, and they're disproportionate to what it costs, say, for housing in some places. Is there anything to that argument?
Well, let's take Wisconsin, for example. Wisconsin is maintained their minimum wage. If they were to raise the wages to be at least $13, I think it's $13.28, a person will be able to afford a one-bedroom apartment in a much easier way than they are depending on a minimum wage dollar. Also, we are finding, and what the researchers have said, is that many people who will be greatly affected will be those in the South. The South is predominantly black and brown. There's a predominantly a number of people who work in the service industry. So by location and race and gender, there's a lot of things that could a lot of ways that people could be definitely helped if this was to change.
Some people point toward larger corporations saying, okay, they can afford this. This maybe means smaller dividends, smaller profit margins. But we hear a lot of times when we talk about minimum wage increases, and we may hear today from smaller business owners who say, I'd love to pay my workers more, but the labor cost would really cut into a very narrow profit margin. I'm just kind of staying ahead of the game here. Are there sectors of the economy that could lose out here?
There are. I mean, we have to be honest. There will be small business and family-owned businesses that will definitely be affected by this particular requirement of a federal minimum at $15. However, there is a gradual phase-in. It's not immediate. There are major corporations like McDonald's, Walmart, Target, Amazon, who have decided to make this an issue. Three of those, Amazon, Target, and McDonald's, have already decided to move to the $15 an hour minimum wage. So there's ways that this could work. However, the small business person will be affected. But I think looking at the gradual phase-in, it could be a way to help them not have the hit be so hard at first.
Why do we end up with the number 15? A lot of the activism, I mean, 15 is in the name of some of the activist drives here. What is it about that number, or at least that range?
Well, $15 is not a living wage. It's a wage that is better than this particular one. But if you look at our current way of looking at how we define poverty, if you look at our current minimum wage, our current minimum wage is at a poverty rate. If you are a full-time worker making minimum wages, you're going to make about $15,000 a year. If you're going to go with this new figure, it's going to be about $30,000 a year. So the idea of the fight for 15 has been a long term mantra that people have used because they're looking at there are ways where you have a better standard of living for someone making $30,000 a year versus 15. And also it will lift people out of poverty, at least 1.3 million people, based on our current way of defining poverty.
An argument we used to hear a lot against increasing the minimum wage was the idea that the minimum wage jobs are the teens, the younger workers, their starter jobs. They're going to move into something else down the line. If that ever was true, is it true now?
No, people often think it's the teens. There was a major study by the Economic Policy Institute out of D.C. that shows that primary people who are working in those jobs are primarily women with children in the age about in their mid-30s. Some teens may have those jobs, but that's not what they're dependent on for their day-to-day existence. It's primarily those who are in their early 30s who have these jobs. And even now with an aging population, people are in their 60s, 70s working at McDonald's or other places like that where they're minimum wage and serving in the service industry.
What do you make of the rise of minimum wage as a pretty prominent political issue? We have the fight for 15, often including restaurant fast food workers. Now we have it very prominent with the House actually passing a bill that probably, again, won't pass the Republican-controlled Senate. But it's definitely on the table in a way that it doesn't seem like it was a few years ago.
There's been a major discussion around inequality and how do we deal with inequality. People like my colleagues, Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton, who have done a lot of work looking at the whole idea of providing baby bonds and other ways in reparations, has been a major discussion. But also amongst the Democratic Party, they have decided to have an economic platform to reduce inequality amongst those who have historically not had the same access to services and benefits that others have had access to historically.
We're talking to David Pate, chair and professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. He's with us to talk about a plan that passed the U.S. House yesterday. It would raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, step by step for a six-year period, not likely to pass or maybe even get a vote in the U.S. Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of gradually raising the minimum wage to that $15 an hour mark? Do you work at minimum wage yourself? If so, what's it like trying to cover bills, housing, and a minimum wage salary? If you're a business owner, what would this kind of change mean for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about a plan that would more than double the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour over the next 6 years. The plan passed with a majority of Democratic votes in the U.S. House yesterday. It's not expected to pass the U.S. Senate. David Pate is with us from UW-Milwaukee School of Social Welfare and the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should we raise the minimum wage? Why or why not? Are you living at minimum wage yourself? Tell us what that is like. What would this increase mean for you? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Lynn is with us in Milwaukee. Lynn, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Lynn?
Well, I run nonprofit organizations, homeless shelters, soup kitchens, food pantries, and we had to cut health insurance last year on our full-time staff people just to give $12.50 an hour, to go from $10 to $12.50 an hour. I don't think we need a $15 an hour minimum. I think what we need is health insurance. You know, it doesn't make any difference. You can't pay people $2 an hour more and expect that they're going to get their bills paid. What we really need is to be able to provide health insurance for them. If I could hire people at $12.50 an hour, if we had health insurance provided.
Lynn, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, David?
I agree with Lynn that people should have health care access, but also I think that people should be paid for their worth. I think that we should have a minimum wage that allows people to be able to afford an apartment. I really applaud a nonprofit that's at least paying someone $12, but as research has shown, at least a $13 plus hourly wage in Wisconsin would allow for decent housing and access to decent housing or a one-bedroom apartment in Wisconsin. So I think it's one, you don't want to give up one for the other. You need both in order to have a decent way of living in this country.
Thanks, Lynn, for the call. We'll go to Kevin now in Dodge County. Kevin, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think?
And this is a question, not a statement. So it's going to be a question. But Oregon tried this, $15 an hour. And what happened was these small businesses with 3-4 employees, they shut their doors. And then Oregon, I think it was Oregon, but then they repealed that to try to get these businesses back. You know, who's going to pay the $15 an hour? Big companies can afford that, but little startups, you know, the thing that made this country, little small startups, they can't afford it. If their employee is only making them $9 an hour and they pay them $15 an hour, they're not going to be able to pay their electric bills and stuff.
Kevin, thanks for the call. What have we seen in other places that have tried this, David?
I mean, many places are definitely seeing the issues that small businesses are having or family-owned businesses. They are not always being able to attend to the idea of having a higher minimum wage. I'm not going to sit here and say that it's going to be easy. I do think we need to decide as a country, how do we value people's worth as a worker? How do we decide what is important to provide in terms of service and pay them for what they provide?
Thanks a lot for the call, Kevin. Joseph joins us now in Madison. Joseph, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for taking me. I was wondering if you think that it will have a detrimental effect on the people that are currently earning less than the $15 an hour wage, because don't you figure that there's going to be greater competition at $15 than there is at, say, $9?
So more people, I guess, competing for that $15 job, it might lure more people into the job market, maybe, David?
I'm not sure. Really, I have to admit, I'm not sure how to really answer that one. I think it would be a great idea to have more people lured into the market. We need workers. We need people paying taxes. We need people to be able to spend money. That I think would be a great thing. But also, I think we need to attend to the fact that some people have not been in the market in a way that allows them to spend and take care of their families. So I think we also need to have accompanying policies that are not just this one policy. There needs to be a better look at earned income tax credit, relaxing licensing of occupational jobs, increasing improving infrastructure, spending more on low-income housing. I think there's a number of things that need to go along with this particular policy.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to David Pate from the UW-Milwaukee School of Social Welfare and the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison, looking at the minimum wage after the U.S. House passed a plan that would increase it over 6 years, ultimately ending up at $15 an hour after that six-year span, not expected to pass in the Senate. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mark joins us in Madison. Mark, hi.
Hi. So they're not addressing the root problem, which has been for 20 years we've been exporting jobs for minimally skilled people to China and elsewhere. So while General Motors and Ford have announced they're going to stop building cars in the U.S., they're building more and more every year in China. And those are the people that are now going to have minimum, are in the minimum wage situation. They used to be $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year jobs. Those jobs have been exported. And instead of dealing with that, what we have in Congress is a bunch of lazy individuals that just want to throw a Band-Aid on it. They want to jump up the minimum wage, which will result in more inflation. And in the long run, those people will be even worse off, even if we go to $20 an hour minimum wage.
Mark, thanks for the call. Mark saying the root cause is we've lost the good-paying jobs that people used to be able to get without a college degree.
That, I mean, as someone who studies industry in Milwaukee, that's true. It's a big deal because it's much cheaper to do some of this work somewhere else. But again, that's a bigger, larger discussion that we need to have as a country about, well, how do we value people's worth and what they contribute to society in terms of their how we should pay them.
Thanks for the call. Todd joins us next in Merrill. Todd, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think?
I think the minimum wage should be raised a little bit, slightly, but the company I work for, we can't even find people to come and work for us, and we're paying starting and no experience at $22, $23 an hour. And what? The trickle-down effect from, like, grocery stores, your can of corn is going to be $5 now.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. So he's worried that costs for consumers would go up if, say, the grocery store had to pay people more money.
I'm sure that economists have looked at this particular issue. I'm sure that our current administration has thought about this and previous administrations. I think that we need to really figure out how to do this. I think it's, if nothing else, a conversation has begun about why do we need to increase the minimum wage. And for the last 10 years, we haven't done anything. So we need to figure out what do we want to pay people who are providing daily services that are very important to the operations of our society.
Thanks for the call. I wanted to get a little more into inequality. You mentioned that earlier, David. What do you see when you look at inequality in the United States? Has it been on the rise in recent decades?
I mean, depending on what cities and states you look at, inequality has been a consistent issue within our country. Historically, we've made policies that have been federal and state that have ensured some people do not have the same access to services. One of the benefits that has been seen by this particular bill has been done by particular researchers at UC Berkeley, is that they said the one thing this would do was allow people to have the opportunity to have access. I do think that inequality, if it's not on the rise, is still still at a place that is very disproportionately black and brown people and women who don't have the same opportunities that they would have if they were within a different space or different gender or race. It's just a reality. And I think we need to figure out how we're going to handle that.
And on a related issue, and a bit of a tangent, you mentioned some of your colleagues working on the idea of baby bonds.
Yes.
I've heard the phrase. I don't know anything about how they work. What would that be?
Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton, Darity who's at North Carolina and Hamilton who's at Ohio State University, had proposed this idea several years ago that people who are born in our country, every child should be guaranteed some level of financial benefit upon birth. Depending on their family's income, it wouldn't be the same, but everyone should start out at a space where they all have some equal space, equal footing as to how they decide to either go to college or go into a trade school. But we as a country would decide to make sure all children, no matter who they are, have some way of being able to be taken care of. So that's why it's called baby bonds. It starts at birth and it goes through your life to your 18.
And David, just in our last few moments, do you expect to see minimum wage be talked about a lot? Probably won't pass the Congress right now. Is it going to be a big issue, do you think, on the campaign trail 2020?
Oh, I think it's going to be a major campaign trail. I think that one of the major platforms for those who identify as Democratic are that they want to look at this whole idea of economic opportunities, economic policy. And because of this particular bill, and it's been a while for it to be passed, they're definitely going to say that we need to be able to provide people with wages that are going to allow them to take care of themselves and their families in ways that are economically solvent.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
That's David Pate with UW-Milwaukee School of Social Welfare and the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about the idea of a federal $15 minimum wage. The U.S. House approved a plan to do that yesterday. Looks like it's pretty unlikely to pass the Senate. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he will not bring that to a vote. Coming up Monday on Central Time, white nationalist movements have captured a lot of attention in the United States in recent years. We'll talk to the author of a new book who digs into their ideology, their public relations, and their dream of a white ethno-state, and along with that, the rise of the so-called alt-right movement. As communities around the United States prepare for the floods of the future, a lot of them rely on levees. But our guest says those levees are not always reliable when the water starts to rise, and communities should start looking at different ways to deal with the risks of flooding. And it's the biggest play in the world of baseball. It's happening more and more often. Is it bad for the game? Our guest says the major leagues are facing a home run crisis. You can let us know what you think if you're a baseball fan. Are there too many home runs? Nothing really happens during them. Let us know if you think it's good for the game. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. That look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time.